I love to bring you things that interest me, as you know, on this program. And I love to bring you things that make us think, things that challenge us. And this book here, I've got to say, is interesting. Christopher Walsh joins me now. He's got a new book out from Triumph Books. And it's called Nick Saban Versus College Football, The Case for College Football's Greatest Coach. And Christopher, first thing I want to do is welcome you to your Tony Basilio show. And great to talk to you, man.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
The subject, Nick Saban, sort of a polarizing figure in college football, isn't he?
A little bit. He's kind of one of those guys, either you like him or you hate him, and a lot of times it has to do with if he's the coach of your favorite team or he's the coach of the team that you hate. He's an interesting guy, and I think there's absolutely no doubt that he is right now the best coach in college football. When you win 4 national championships, the pedigree, the rings, everything, Alabama is on just an incredible roll right now, and I think as long as he's still there, it's going to keep going.
You know, from your work at Bama Online and then also Tuscaloosa News before that, I know you've had a chance to cover this team for several years. You were there before he got there, and you've been there to watch the ascent back to prominence of Alabama football. What is it about Alabama post-Saban that has them as hot as they've been since the Bryant days?
Well, you have to go back to two factors. And number one, the first one is Mel Moore. He became the athletic director, and he was, look, we are not going to keep going at this level. And let's call it what it is. Alabama was a mess, and it wasn't just football. It was pretty much all the programs. They needed new facilities. They needed to get fans back involved. They needed a lot of things. If you were going to try to compete at the highest level, they just couldn't do it with the setup that they had. So Mel came in, started a huge fundraising drive that was just enormously successful, and that kind of started them down the path. Two renovations of the football stadium, changing the practice facility, the new weight room. A lot of that really started with that initial drive. Actually, in the 11 years I've been in Tuscaloosa, every single facility except for swimming, I think that's correct, has been overhauled in some shape, manner, form, whatever. That allowed them then to go after the coach that they wanted, obviously, was Nick Saban. And granted, you know, there were some other names that were being mentioned at the time. Part of the problem was I don't think he really thought that he could get Nick Saban. And then he put all his chips on the table and he went after him and he got him. Now we look at the results. It's been almost phenomenal.
No, there's no doubt about that. The most recent appearance by Alabama in a national championship game, which was just, the game was over after the first quarter. How many times do you see that? It's child's play in certain circles. And yet with Nick Saban, as I look at you unpack this, and you did a really nice job of unpacking it, let me pick at you for a couple things here. I noticed a couple things. First of all, and I can tell from being around you, you're a pretty good sport. I want to make an observation to you. Tell me if I'm wrong. The folks at Triumph Books, I'm going to go to the cover of your book. I see Bowden's name. I see, you know, you're laughing. I see Bowden's name. I see a line through it. I see Spurrier's name. I see a line through it. I see Hayes's name. I see a line through it. The late, great Woody Hayes. Urban Meyer, I see a line through it. In fact, you could put 4 or 5 lines through Meyer's name, and I'm not going to complain, and neither will a lot of people. Newt Rockne's name's got a line through it. Bo Schembechler's name's got a line through it. Tom Osborne's name's got a line through it. I see a name missing here. And by the way, Christian Lundy, son of the late, great Gary Lundy, from Knoxville News Sentinel fame, noticed this along with Sean Sinclair recently on one of my programs. They said, where is Bear Bryant's name, and why is there no line through that?
Well, let me go back into the origins of the book, and it'll kind of explain itself here. I was actually down at the national championship game when Alabama defeated Notre Dame. I'm in Miami. It's like 2 days beforehand. And the publisher that I have written numerous books for contacted me and said, hey, we have that book, Tom Brady versus the NFL. And it's a book basically where the writer tries to make the case that Tom Brady is the best quarterback in NFL history. He's like, you know, we really like it. We were wondering if you might be interested in doing something like that, maybe with Nick Saban. And my initial reaction was, no, I can't do that. But what I could do is if there was a Mount Rushmore of college football coaches, say during the modern era, that Saban would already have his place on it. And they were like, yeah, that's great. We love that. We love that. So that's where the book started. And then I actually did all the research, and you know, I kind of had in the back of my head who the four coaches were going to be, but I didn't know. It's like I had to crunch all the numbers first. And when the numbers came out, and Saban's numbers, they definitely held up, and he definitely should be there. I breathed a little sigh of relief. But when we got down to doing the cover, they did the cover just like they did the Tom Brady cover. And the Tom Brady cover, you know, just like Marino and all these other quarterbacks, and their names are scratched out. Well, they showed me the initial cover. My suggestion was, you can't put anyone's name on there who is in the Mount Rushmore. I was like, that's not fair. It doesn't work. But I took one look at the cover, and actually right at eye level, where now there's Steve Spurrier, was Joe Paterno's name. And I kind of switched gears, and I was like, okay, if you're going to make one change to the cover, please get Joe Paterno's name off that, because A, Saban had a lot of respect for him, and B, history's kind of determined Paterno's status and his legacy. And I think we're beginning to get a feel for it now, but it's probably going to take longer. That was the change that they made. And I'll go ahead and let your listeners know, the four coaches that I have singled out are Saban, Bear Bryant, Bobby Bowden, and Newt Rockne. And they kept Rockne and Bowden on the cover, but they didn't put Bryant on there. So, yeah, it's a consistency. I'll give you that one.
Yeah. And, hey, we love honesty. The ultimate question becomes, how does Paul Bear Bryant stack up to Nick Saban? And furthermore, are the old-timers offended by your treatment of Paul Bear Bryant versus Nick Saban in this book? Because I'd imagine at Alabama there are some old guard folks who are, I would say, probably the 50 and over crowd that are holding on to Paul Bear Bryant. Is that so?
There's definitely an element of truth there. He is still the legend, and he's still the man with a hound's tooth, and the status is really never going to go away. The man is going to be revered in Tuscaloosa forever. Now, having said that, one of the things that we do in the book is put Saban's numbers side by side with other coaching legends. And it's not just the four guys that I mentioned before. There's about 20 guys that we do that comparison with. So like I mentioned Paterno, or if you think Nalen's the best coach of all time, you can go look at the numbers and you can make the case for yourself and say, hey, I think this guy's the best because of it. Having said that, in my mind, after crunching all the numbers and spending really 2 years going through all this, I think Saban is definitely in the ballpark now with Bryant. I think if he wins one more national championship, you and I could have a conversation that would last through the night about who's the better coach. I think if he wins two more, it's over. I think Saban will go down as the greatest coach in college football history. And I think that's his goal at this point.
So right now, having written the book, and it is available from Triumph, I would call this more than a Nick Saban deal. It's sort of a celebration of college football. You look at all these legendary guys. They're wonderful bodies of work. Everybody has chinks in their armor. Saban had his time at Michigan State where he didn't exactly light the world on fire, but he had an okay run there. He's got the series with Auburn. Nobody's perfect. Bowden had his trials with Miami. Joe Paterno had the fact that he didn't play the toughest schedule in the world. Bear Bryant probably didn't have as tough an SEC as currently exists. So if we're sitting around a bar, we could argue for any of these guys, couldn't we?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate what you just said, because that was one of the aims of the book. I wanted it to be a celebration of college football and of college football coaches, and I wanted it to be a lot more than an Alabama or a Nick Saban book, even though obviously it's geared towards that. There's a thing about dynasties. There's a thing about the best players to ever play for Saban, not just at Alabama, but all of his stops. The comparisons that we do, we've got a section on current coaches. We've got a section on past coaches. I do kind of so this is my Mount Rushmore. If you were going to do like a second team, this would be the second team. And then there's also who would be the four guys of the innovators, if you will, the legends who kind of turned football from really was a different sport when it started out into what it is now.
As we visit today with Christopher Walsh, and who I'm going to refer to as Chris Walsh now, because that's what we do. That's how we roll around here, actually. Christopher's really done a nice job, though, with this book, Nick Saban versus College Football. Even though I did haze him some on the cover, and he did say to me, hey, it's Derek Dooley noted, which I do appreciate the fact that he owned it, and he said, hey, I had two guys that were on my Mount Rushmore who have lines through them, but you're not dare going to put a line through the name of Bear Bryant. That's just not going to happen.
No, try to avoid that one.
I would say that's probably a pretty decent idea in your part. I mentioned the kryptonite for Nick Saban, which is the Auburn series. I think his number is what, 0-6 when Auburn has a certain record? What's the record? What is that number people are spouting?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. That's sleep deprivation, unfortunately. But it's kind of interesting following him in his career. When he was at Michigan State, his kryptonite was Purdue. He couldn't beat Drew Brees. Just torched him over and over again. More recently, it was LSU. How was Alabama going to get past LSU? Because it was really the only team that physically matched up whenever they played. Now the perception is it's going to be Auburn. I'm not one of those people who sit there and say the best way to beat a Saban defense is go no huddle and speed things up. I've seen too many teams try that kind of thing before. And granted, Auburn played a great game and won last year. I'm not buying in like other people are. Granted, you can have some success, but it was a special teams play that decided the game last year, not necessarily an offensive play. Granted, that last drive that Auburn did was very impressive, and that's where you tip your hat. Ole Miss last year got shut out by Alabama. You know, and you go back to when Florida was at its heyday with Urban Meyer, and Alabama went to the SEC championship and ended what people thought was going to be a dynasty there. So don't count out Nick Saban is the point I'm trying to make.
That series, though, that is interesting. When Auburn wins eight or nine games, I believe the number is, it's stark, and it's interesting for a guy with Saban's cachet and his record and just the way they've crushed people. And I go back to that championship game against Notre Dame, which was an absolute statement, which is, you don't belong on the field with us. You're not even in the same league with us. Don't even try, literally and figuratively, to come out here and bring that stuff out here. My observation for you about Saban is, and this is as a Saban hater, I'm a Saban hater, but at least I'll admit it to you, is this. Here's a guy, it seems to me, that the game has changed a little bit, and you reference this with the offenses that are faster, the whining, the off-field, let's change the rules. You mentioned that a little bit. We can't run from that, though, can we? I mean, he really has whined about it this offseason.
I tell you what, this guy can't breathe with five TV cameras suddenly turning on and flashing in his face. That's been the thing that's really kind of caught me about his rise. He kind of became sort of a spokesman for college football, and I think that kind of surprised him a little bit. It also kind of corresponded a little bit with the tornado that happened in Alabama, where suddenly Saban wasn't just a football coach. He really kind of became a community leader, if you will. I mean, he's going to be loved in Tuscaloosa for the rest of his life because of a lot of things that he did after the tornado struck. But when you start talking about the rule changes, I think he's got an interesting point when he says, we need to know, does this hurt athletes by playing more plays? Because remember, like 5-6 years ago, there was that huge thing about, hey, we're going to change the rules, we're going to shorten the games because players are out there too much, there's too many concussions, and so forth. And it's like everyone else forgot that that was the emphasis of college football, literally like 5 years ago. I don't have a problem with him saying, let's try to make sure that we're doing the right thing here. He's also been one of those guys who's come out and said, look, if we expand the playoffs, where do we draw the line? How many games is too many? And I think he makes a really, really good point there, because I watch SEC football week in, week out, and I see the injuries that these guys get league-wide. It's not small potatoes here. These guys really get beat up, and it is a grind. We're getting closer and closer to college football being like a professional thing. If we're going to keep this as you're going to be students, that amateur thing, I think you really, really got to kind of question about if we add another playoff game, now all of a sudden we're potentially playing 16 games. That's a lot. Every single time he talks, people are really, really listening. No matter what he says, people are going to jump all over him.
Yeah, which ironically enough is, I think, a role that Joe Paterno had for many, many years. He was the guy the national media went to for his take on amateurism issues, safety issues. And ironically enough, the demise that Joe Paterno met at the end of his career, as I grew up in a Penn State family, was one that I think many of us would like to forget. And yet at the same time, I think our society needs to learn from, and hopefully we do, as we're visiting today with Christopher Walsh. He's the author of Nick Saban Versus College Football. It's available from Triumph Books. I encourage you to pick it up. Let's go back here real quick to the safety issue as it relates to the speed of play. And then I want to get back to your book here for a second. But you touched on something there. And Saban's point is, let's make the game safer. I've got an excellent friend who's been an administrator in college football for a long, long time. And he started in coaching, and now he's in administration at an SEC school. And he told me, he said, you know, this speed of play issue that people talk about, these new offenses, they're going to be good for the game because teams have to adapt. And I think of teams like Alabama that have gigantic linemen, interior defensive linemen, that cannot play at that pace. It's going to force guys to get more normal sized. And thus, when guys start coming back down in size, when linebackers get a little smaller so they can run a little bit in space, and we go back more to the Jimmy Johnson model instead of the jumbo model that we've gotten to these days, you're going to see a safer game.
I think he's definitely right about the defensive players in particular getting smaller. I mean, we're already seeing that, like, with linebackers and nickel situations to start games. I mean, you've got to have a lot of defensive backs or you're in serious, serious trouble. I think he definitely makes an interesting point that should be part of the conversation. Which direction do you want to go in with college football? And I think you got to get the pros involved as well. This is how they get ready to go to the NFL. So the NFL keeps going on this trend where it's pass, 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 pass. You're going to see it trickle down more into the college game. But on the flip side of that, I'm one of those guys that still thinks defense wins championships, because if you can't stop someone, you don't have a prayer. And we kind of saw that last year, because Big 12, perfect example, there's a conference that's totally embraced offense and not so much in the defense, hasn't won a national championship in a long time. So, but we'll see.
Bear Bryant aside, who's your number two to Saban when you did the research? And I'll give you mine. In fact, he's my number one simply because I've never seen a run like what this guy did at Florida in the 90s. And I maintain that he walked out of there in his own volition. Spurrier has always been an emotional guy. And sure, the pros gave him a soft landing spot for a couple of years. And ironically enough, he's a miserable failure in the pros. Saban's a failure in the pros. Both of these guys are college football coaches. It's where they belong. Spurrier's mine, and I say to you that if he stays at Florida, there's no telling what they could have done in the last decade and a half. I think he could have thrown up some gigantic numbers, especially with the Saban vacuum there for a couple of years. I'd like your thoughts on that.
We're only talking active coaches, right?
You can talk whoever you want to talk. But go ahead.
Three guys jump to mind. The first barometer has got to be national championships. You got to have at least a ring. So that narrows the list down to about six, seven guys. The three that kind of popped in my head right off the bat, Spurrier, Urban Meyer, and you know what? I'll throw Les Miles in there. Even though he inherited quite a lot from Saban at LSU, he did a really nice job of keeping that going. And I'm a big believer at LSU. They seem to kind of reload every year. They've got a ton of talent. I don't know if he's ever going to win another title there, but they're going to be in the hunt pretty much every single season. So I guess for me, the argument would come down, are you a Spurrier guy, are you an Urban Meyer guy? And that's a tough one. That's a toss-up in my book. I still think we have a ways to go on that one, especially since Urban Meyer is so young.
Christopher Walsh, his book is available from Triumph Books. It's called Nick Saban Versus College Football. You can also check out his work at Saturday Down South. Those folks do a terrific job as well. And hey, Christopher, on the way out here, this season's going to be really interesting. The West is going to be a bloodletting. When Roy Kramer, who lives in our backyard here, first came up with the idea of the SEC championship game, everybody said, you're nuts. Your teams are going to beat on each other. You're never going to get a chance to play for national championships. And the exact opposite happened. They went to that model and the league took off. I think with this playoff here in this first year, it could be a little ironic, because I think the strength of the league resides in the West. And I could see those West teams beating on each other to the point where it might open the door for somebody else to jump into one of the four playoff slots. Do you see that being a possibility?
Yeah, it's kind of funny you mentioned that, Kramer and all, because the first national championship game I attended was actually when Tennessee beat Florida State. I was working out west in Phoenix, and just what an amazing run the conference has been on. Yeah, I could see that. I don't think that's too much of a stretch by any means. It's going to change everything. Instead of one team being in there, four teams. Go back a couple years ago when Alabama lost and needed three teams to lose, Oregon and Kansas State, I want to say. But there was like three teams, and they had to have all three results basically to get back in the national championship. And all three happened like boom, boom, boom. And you're kind of like, wow, you know, that's when you see when the pressure is mounting, how it really can affect everyone. I'm kind of wondering, are we going to see more teams run the table and go undefeated, or are we going to see fewer teams? It's going to be really, really interesting to watch. Could this backfire a little bit on the SEC? Yeah, definitely, because I think this year, except for one or two teams at the very top, well, no, I'll even say it. I think it's more wide open in general because just there's so much talent in the East. To say that people are picking Missouri fourth, I'm just kind of shaking my head like, you got to be kidding me. But who do you bump down kind of thing? That's the problem. And then in the West, I think you got to say Alabama's probably the favorite, although Auburn, you're talking 1A and 1B in my mind at worst. LSU is always tough. I don't think A&M's going to drop off as much as people think. And the Mississippi schools, they seem to be in a real good position. It's going to be, what did you say, bloodletting, bloodbath? It's going to be a heck of a season.
Christopher, thanks, man. And on the way out here, let me give you the final word on your book.
Just the general idea of the book was to try to pinpoint Nick Saban's place in history. And I think we've made a pretty good argument. Thing that really works in our favor is that there's been no book on Nick Saban since the one he wrote 10 years ago. So if you're interested in college football, if you're interested in college football coaches, hopefully this is the book for you.
It's really fun, and you did a great job with it. And congratulations on the work and the stuff you guys are doing at Saturday Down South. And if you can, keep Stephen Garcia in line. I don't know if you can do that. That sounds like a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week deal, but good luck to you, man.
It's fun getting to know him a little bit. So it's I'm really Saturday Down South and loving every second of it. So, but thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, great talking with you. And we'll come back with more right after this.